welcome back. Coming up on this week's show, I'll look back at 2020 memorable moments. Peacock announces news about popularity of the Premier League games. News about a brand new soccer TV schedules app. Talk Sport pulls the plug on Premier League radio broadcasts. Plus, we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, and I'm joined alongside my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar. Kartik, we've got a lot to get to in this podcast. This one's a little bit more delayed than usual. Usually we release it on a Thursday. Well, I'll explain more in a little bit. But I want to dive right in, Kartik, because this past weekend, so we're Boxing Day weekend, I know both you and I have watched a lot of games separately. I think for me personally, it's not about the quantity, it is about the quality, but for me it's a fun way to spend a weekend, especially when it's cold outside. Even in Florida it's cold. So for me it was 7 Premier League games this weekend, 2 championship games, so over like 13 hours worth of soccer. And the one aspect about this, I mean, the games themselves, I don't think there were any stunners or any like, oh my gosh, what an amazing game this weekend from the Boxing Day weekend. But for me, the thing that keeps me interested and keeps me watching these games, other than my love of soccer and football, is the Fantasy Premier League. And I'm playing and I'm watching it, and I'm watching the Wolves and Spurs game probably a little bit more closely because, I mean, is Son going to get another assist or goal? Is that going to help me? What about you, Kartik? How do you stand in terms of Fantasy Premier League and that having kind of a magnetic bond that helps you watch more games than you would normally?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm on edge every match, and the staggered kickoffs have made it difficult. So even when I'm not able to watch a match, which wasn't the case this weekend, but was, for example, the case the previous weekend, and Newcastle was playing Fulham in a late match, and I was constantly checking my phone to see what was going on. And I think I've told the story of the early morning that I had on the Biden campaign, where and I was actually in close quarters with people on the Trump campaign, and I'm nervously checking my phone. Southampton was playing Villa, and there was like a goal in every minute in that match, and even the Trump campaign people thought it was just really amusing. And it's like, oh well, and I've explained to them fantasy, and they kind of understood. It's like someone checking their stock tabs. This weekend, Chris, I think was really tough for everybody who plays fantasy. And for those who haven't heard it before, I play in actually a kind of a very competitive money league that we've had for, 7 or 8 seasons now, because it's all former Fort Lauderdale Strikers employees. And I only had 9 guys that were fit that I could play with. I still won the week. My opponent only had 9 guys that were fit. And fortunately for me, among the 9 guys that were fit, I'm actually looking, as we're speaking, at my scoring from the week. I had Matty Cash, who had a really big game for Villa. I had Anthony Robinson, who had a very big game for Fulham, has been really consistent for me. Decore, who had a good game for Everton. Suchek, and then Ollie Watkins, who's just money for me every week. Calvert-Lewin had a bad match, but I was still able to win in spite of that. My opponent had got a lot of points as well. I mean, he had Saiz that was fit. Mm-hmm. He had Christian Pulisic. He had Tammy Abraham, but he only had 9 guys also. So it was difficult. And I noticed around the whole of my league, everybody else had this same problem. I mean, I've been really dependent on guys like Vestergaard and Antonio to get me points this season. They both are injured now. My very first pick in the draft was Aubameyang, which is a bomb. You know, I almost want to release him rather than even trade him to another person in my league. So that's and now that Arsenal have shown they can score 3 goals without him playing, I'm wondering whether Arteta works him back into the team or not.
Yeah, it does show that real life does intersect with fantasy soccer games, because you've got everything from injuries, but also COVID. I mean, some of the players testing positive for COVID at the last minute, not being able to play, so on and so forth. But from this past weekend, well, actually the Boxing Day weekend of coverage by NBC Sports, I mean, most of the games we watched, I watched too, were on NBC Sports. I mean, watched some ESPN Plus now and again. but a pretty uneventful weekend in terms of NBC Sports' coverage. Nothing bad, nothing great. But I would say that Danny Higginbotham yet again stood out, and just the level of analysis that he provides, and how he's quite different than what we've had in the past on that show. And while I was typing up my notes this weekend for this podcast, I was thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I totally forgot about Tim Howard. Like, is he on vacation? Maybe spending time with his family for Christmas holidays, which is great. But Danny Higginbotham definitely was the star of the show. And I think Big Sam was too, because he definitely overcame a lot of anti-Big Sam feelings, which are out there in social media. It's incredible how many people just despise this guy. And to me, I mean, he does it. I mean, he delivers results. There's a reason that clubs hire a manager like this. And West Brom may have made one of the smartest moves on a managerial front this season by appointing him before somebody else does.
Yeah, a couple points there. Absolutely correct on Danny Higginbotham. He knows the league, and he'll talk about the teams that NBC's other analysts have stopped talking about or wouldn't talk about in the first place. Although, actually, when they first got the rights, Robbie Musto was very deeply endowed in a lot of the teams outside the top six and would talk about them regularly. And there's just been a shift in direction. So whether it's talking about Fulham, I pointed this out in the article I wrote about Danny Higginbotham a week and a half ago or so. Whether it was talking about Fulham in his first weekend on the broadcast, his very first match day, where he talked about Southampton and Brighton, which is something that generally they would just say, okay, Southampton, Brighton, this was the result. Let's move on to talk about Manchester United, right? That would be the typical NBC refrain. He prevented them from doing that. And then this weekend, I think talking about how good Aston Villa was, some of the things about Aston Villa, although I guess Villa is one team that they will talk about anyway, because Robbie Musto is a former teammate of Dean Smith's, right? So yep. He does have an insight into that. But still, more deeper analysis about Villa, and then some very, very good analysis about Big Sam. You know, I'm not always having to turn to ESPN FC to get really top shelf analysis anymore, although ESPN FC was fantastic yesterday talking about Lampard and his deficiencies. Let me ask you a question, Chris. You mentioned Big Sam. Why do you think so many people have a hatred for Big Sam? Why do you think so many people tweet nasty things about him? And why do you think so many people repeat these old tired comments about him? Because my theory is that they've been told to. That people have not actually watched the teams that Sam managed very closely. They have not watched the type of football he's played. I think certainly you can take a stereotype from his time at Bolton and then that stint at Blackburn. Throw out the Newcastle stint. That doesn't matter to me. But then if you start with his time at West Ham, there's been an evolution in how he plays and how he adjusts to the guy to the personnel he has. And there's a reason why he's such a specialist at this, because he can take any set of personnel, scout the opposition, create a tactical setup for that personnel. It's very different than Tony Pulis, who does have a set way of playing. So I ask you, Chris, why is there such a narrative about Big Sam that ignores this reality of his coaching CV and his body of work? Is it because my theory is that the media has effectively told fans and people who like to comment on social media about football what to say about Big Sam, and people think it makes them sound more sophisticated if they knock this guy without really having a clue?
Yeah, so there's a combination of things. I think in England, in the UK, it is very much a basically a kind of an anti Big Sam, as far as just I think the playing style, just that it is. He does negate. I mean, his teams do negate the attacking kind of style of play of some of the teams that you love to watch. If it's Liverpool, they're just attacking and just looking. It's so exciting to watch, but then he sets his teams up to really negate that, right? To kind of stop them, prevent them from doing that. and playing. At times, it can be a counter-attacking style of play. At times, it can be five in the back. It can be just a very strong, resolute defensive performance. And I think actually the UK side of things, I think that's a global thing, right? But the UK thing, I think it is very much a they love the foreign managers. They love the French managers. They love the Italian managers. And oftentimes they don't give a lot of time and patience to their own managers, the English managers. And we talked about this in last week's podcast, a Northern manager too. So kind of manager that's from, you know, I think he was born in Birmingham area and kind of more of a Northern person. So that's the UK side of things, kind of a, you mean they love to see, you mean the grass is always greener on the other side, like to see some of these foreign managers that are more exciting style of play, kind of a little bit more cosmopolitan perhaps. Universally, I think it is one of those things where it is a, you mean they don't like the style of play. In the US, and I came across this tweet and I saw it and I read it and I couldn't believe what it said. And I thought, like, well, maybe he's joking. But then again, I think he's being serious. But somebody, I'll just read this out, Kartik. It's from Kevin Kincaid, or Kevin Kincaid, Kincaid, I guess it is. And he says, he tweeted to this today, "Say what you will about Major League Soccer, but the lack of pro rel thankfully means that managers like Sam Allardyce are not needed." So I think that's part of it. The US side of things, where you see a lot of negativity about Sam Allardyce, is because the job he does is to go in, like Jim Beglin said in today's commentary, he's a fixer. He's a fix-it man. He will go in, if a team's looking like they're going to get relegated, he will go in and save them, keep them up, which financially has enormous consequences. For the fan base, it has enormous consequences. It's a positive. And I think that narrative of somebody who is a manager that lives on the edge of that pro-rel kind of barrier and is a really interesting story, whether you love him or hate his style. I think for Major League Soccer, it doesn't fit, right? It's something that doesn't fit into the narrative. Major League Soccer is not used to that. So they kind of almost like see Big Sam as kind of the enemy. I personally, I know you do too, Kartik, but I love Big Sam. He does a job. It's not pretty, but it's effective.
Yeah, it's effective. I'm not sure it's not pretty. It depends on your perspective, right? People are applying, and I've said this, and I know people who follow me for a long time know I've been saying this about Big Sam for 10 years, really since he was getting such shtick from – I liked him before that. Don't get me wrong. I really liked him at Bolton and have given him a lot of credit for innovation in the sport. That's the other narrative that needs to be debunked, that he's some sort of caveman. I mean, in terms of sports science, in terms of technology, in terms of scouting opposition, he was at the cutting edge of English football in terms of, especially among English managers specifically. But this this narrative about, it's unwatchable, it's terrible football, that's your personal preference. You might like Barcelona passing teams to death, or Bayern Munich passing teams to death and 20 and 25 pass sequences for goals. That might be the football you like, but you're imposing your value system. It's like anything ideological or political on everybody else, and forcing them to create an opinion about something else based on your personal biases and personal preferences. So with American commentators, one, the United States does not put a great value on defending in its professional league. Major League Soccer, I didn't follow the league this season, but I followed it the previous 20-some years. And there are generally more goals and more defensive errors and more less organized structural teams at the back than you see in other parts of the world, particularly a Sam Allardyce type team. Secondly, I would point out that this idea that Allardyce always plays one way and that it's always this dire defensive thing is absolute bunk. If you watch Allardyce teams, they're organized based on the opposition. Like I said, it's not like Tony Pulis, who would always have a target guy and then two quick wingers, and they would whip in crosses and then also depend on set pieces. And then obviously when Rory Delap was at Stoke, some long throw-ins. Allardyce's tactics evolve with the personnel he inherits, because as you said, he's very much become a fixer. So he comes in for 6 months, 9 months to a club. doesn't really get transfer windows, has to deal with the personnel he inherits. That is a specific skill I think most managers at the top level of the game do not have. So that's the first point. The second point would be that he does not always set up to sit and defend and then push long balls forward to a target guy and have him play off of a guy. In fact, today you saw what he did is in the second half, he moved Carlin Grant further forward. They were playing some nice quick passes between the lines and springing quick counterattacks. That's very different than just flinging the ball up to a number nine, a target guy, like he used to have in Kevin Davies at Bolton and then at West Ham and in Andy Carroll. It's a different way of playing. With Crystal Palace, remember the performances he got out of Wilf Zaha, really kind of jump-started Wilf Zaha back to the level that we knew he was capable of. I tell you what, there's a few things that annoy me as much as the narratives about Allardyce, as I think you know Chris personally from knowing me, and then a lot of people who follow me on Twitter or social media know. And again, I'm so annoyed by it because the other immovable object in this is Liverpool fans. And Liverpool fans now have gotten spoiled the way Barcelona fans were, and Manchester City fans have become under Pep, and all of these stylists, right? Arsenal fans used to be the worst of it, and that's why Wenger and Arsenal fans hated Allardyce more than any other set of supporters. They're just indignant. They feel like every team should play football the way that they want, the way their team plays. Therefore, every opposition team unilaterally disarms and basically says to Manchester City or Barcelona or Liverpool or Arsenal, hey, you know, we're not as good as you, so just take it. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I think Big Sam makes good television in terms of it's. I mean, to me, I much prefer Big Sam than Slaven Bilic as far as a manager. Slaven Bilic, I see him, and I've said this to one of my friends who's a West Brom former player, but also a fan, is that he's a great Championship manager. I just don't see him being as good in the Premier League. But to me, Big Sam will make for good television between now and the end of the season, and I hope they can do it. I hope they can stay up. I hope that they really give it a good go. They've got a good team. It's not a flash with cash in terms of just some high earners, but they're a hardworking team, and best of luck to the Baggies. Speaking of the Premier League, one of the things, Kartik, I love to hear, and actually this is something that happened this past weekend, was my favorite match of the weekend, which was Leicester against Man United. Really kind of a good ding dong of a game, back and forth, entertaining. But what I love sometimes, and this happens every once in a blue moon, but I was watching the first maybe 10 minutes of this game on mute because it's on, 7:30 on a Saturday morning. Didn't want to wake up the household. And then after about 10 minutes, I switched the volume up a little bit. And all I could hear was the sound of the ball being passed from player to player, and in the background, a little bit of crowd noise. And that silence, having that silence, even if it was for 20 to 30 seconds, and then hearing the commentator mention something, to me, I love that, because it's that kind of that time, that patience, really good balance, where it isn't somebody that's just talking nonstop, filling every second of a match broadcast. It's allowing the game to breathe. It's allowing the game to, kind of basically the commentator taking control of the situation and painting a picture rather than going ahead and telling you a story of what's happening at every second. So yeah, Leicester against Man United, Peter Drury and Jim Beglin, two of the best in the business, and I really loved their commentary and always have done.
Yeah, and I actually have gotten used to hearing the weight of the ball and the weight of passes and that sort of and that's one advantage of there being no crowd, I guess, or minimal crowds in some cases. That match had a minimal crowd. Other matches had no crowds this weekend, depending what tier they're in the UK. But I've actually now enjoyed, Chris, hearing on those long pass sequences the weighting of the passes, the ball being played knocked around. But to make that work, you have to have some silence from the commentators, right? If you have a commentator that's blabbing the whole time, then you don't quite get to appreciate that. So that's actually something that's evolved in 2020. I know we're going to get into 2020 review in a little bit, but that's one of the things that's evolved for me in 2020 is I actually now like hearing the just the passing of the ball, and you can hear it roll, you can hear the touches, etc.
Yeah, definitely. It's a different world. So speaking of 2020, Kartik, you and I were supposed to meet this week. You and I were supposed to meet in person. We were going to do the podcast side by side, take some pictures, maybe do some video. And before I headed down to South Florida, myself and my family all got tested, coronavirus testing. We got rapid testing. The results came back that same day. Everything was negative. We jumped in the car, started heading towards South Florida, where Kartik lives. The day after that, we got the subsequent results that came in, and all of us came back negative on the PCR test. Anyone who's had a COVID test done, and this was precautionary. We just wanted to make sure that we're all, you know, safe and healthy and clean, basically, no COVID, as we meet with Kartik and family, etc. And then the 2 days after that, my wife gets a text message to say, "Hey, your COVID test has been updated." And she's like, "What? That's weird. Like, I've had the rapid test comes back negative, the PCR test comes back negative." And then it says she clicks on the link and to go to the app, and it says that she's positive. And I'm like, "What the heck? Like, how could that possibly be? How could the actual results change?" So as soon as that happened, alarm bells went off in terms of, okay, we have to be really careful now, because what if that result is correct? So myself and the whole family got tested again. We thought, okay, let's just get tested again and see what happens, just to make sure we're safe. And the results came back. And this time we were all negative. We're all negative, except for me. I 2 days later after that, I got a result that came back that said positive. So I had to cancel the opportunity to meet with Kartik to do the podcast. We said, okay, let's do it this weekend, Boxing Day weekend right now. And what I didn't tell you, Kartik, I haven't had a chance to tell you too, is that the day after that, I got tested again and it said negative. And I guess that's more of a tale of cautionary words about the testing, because absolutely insane. Because of course, myself and my family were like worried when any of the negatives came back in terms of the positive testing results, but then got tested again and it said negative, and then got, anyway, it just, what a mess. So for anyone who hasn't gone through that, I don't know. I don't know if it's a Florida thing. I don't know if it's just the types of tests that are being done, but what a crazy week. So at the end of the day, Kartik and I didn't get to get together. Maybe in 2021 we'll finally get a chance, but what a crazy week.
Yeah, what a crazy, crazy week for you, Chris. And the good news is that your family's doing well, you're doing well. Apparently you do not have COVID, but it did curtail our plans, and I think that that's happening with a lot of people out of an abundance of caution, rightfully so.
Yeah, so let's move on to TV streaming news. And by the way, too, I'm 100% healthy, no symptoms. Actually, my entire family, no one has symptoms. We're all being careful. I mean, we're kind of quarantining here back home and just playing it safe. And as we've always done, we've been wearing masks, sanitizing, distancing, the whole thing. But just a crazy kind of basically 3 or 4 days of negative, negative, positive, negative, and just trying to wonder what the heck is going on with this whole system. But in terms of TV streaming news, while I was heading down to South Florida to see Kartik, and then also heading back after just a crazy week of testing, one of the things I got to do quite a bit was listen to some radio broadcasts of games. So for the Premier League. And I found out, just as a lot of other listeners and soccer fans in the US found out, that what we've relied on for so long, which has been Talk Sport and the TuneIn app, which has live broadcasts of most Premier League matches, almost all of them, actually, disappeared. So if you go into TuneIn and try to find a Premier League match, as you've done in the past through the TalkSport live broadcast. Those are all gone. I need to reach out to TalkSport to find out what's going on, if there's a change there. I know that some of the games are available on SiriusXM FC, which is the TalkSport broadcast, but that's not every game. But a lot of question marks about what's happening within TalkSport and how they're broadcasting these games and making them accessible to listeners in the US. So I'll make an effort this week to find out more information. Kartik, have you heard anything about TalkSport and their coverage plans or any changes?
No, I haven't heard anything about any changes, but what I have heard from a source, a pretty good source, is in the UK itself, TalkSport has had a big impact on, or is having an impact on television viewership, and in fact, in kind of the interest of many consumers in watching Premier League matches, because these kickoffs have been staggered, sometimes four different match windows a day, often, on Saturdays and Sundays. And so what's ended up happening is people still want to go about their lives. Yes, there's more accessibility now than ever to Premier League matches on television in the UK. In the past, we've always talked about how the league was more accessible in the United States. So there's some matches free to air on BBC, etc., and then the usual BT and Sky, but you TalkSport is handy wherever you go. So people who are trying to get on with their own lives and can't sit in front of the television for 8 hours are now listening to matches more, from what I understand. The big question is, does this have an impact long term, or is it a temporary coronavirus thing? And if it does happen long term, where more people turn back to the radio to listen to Premier League matches, does it impact the next round of rights negotiations?
Yeah, in many ways, too, our viewing habits have changed, whether you're in the UK or the US or anywhere around the world, because with these games having staggered kickoff times, where most of the games each weekend now it's one after the other, there's a little bit of fatigue syndrome in there, too, where I think it's more likely that we might get fatigued and get a little bit tired of watching the games. We need a break. Normally, of course, I mean, as most listeners would know, normally there's like four or five games happening at the very same time, and you get to kind of pick and choose the ones you want to watch. But that's interesting, too, about the UK and possibly kind of a change there in terms of TV broadcasts and maybe a change in the pent-up demand for that. I think in many ways, especially in the UK, they probably got spoilt in the last 6 months of having so much access or possible access to a lot of these games. And fatigue might be part of it too, where people are like, you know what, I'll just listen to it on the radio. Or, I mean, we're all still working or going about our daily lives. And with them being staggered through a weekend, it means that the number of hours that, I mean, we can watch these games has extended, and not everyone can watch those games on television. So, that, you mean, it's maybe watch some on television, maybe watch one or two, but then listen to some of the other games on the radio as we go to work or drive in our car, whatever it may be. Next up in the news items is something interesting that there was an interview this past week with NBC Universal CEO Jeff Schell. And Jeff Schell, when he got appointed to this position, his number one goal and mantra was Peacock, Peacock, Peacock. It was all in on Peacock. And this goes back to several months where he was just kind of talking about how Peacock is going to be the future of NBC Universal. Well, the interesting thing is in this interview that he did recently, actually I think it was the earnings call, he talked about the rise of Peacock TV from when it launched originally, spring or late spring, to where it is now, and all the programming it's added, and all of the movies and on-demand shows, and all the, for 2021, all the new programming that's coming to Peacock TV. He mentioned, or it was asked, what is the number one driver of subscriptions and engagement to Peacock Premium? And the answer is the Premier League, which I was surprised by, because obviously we know that, I mean, there's a lot of Premier League fans, a lot of soccer fans. If we want to watch a lot of Premier League games, we have to get Peacock TV. But I was expecting some of the TV shows, or, I mean, the series, or the back catalogue, or other things. would be the number one driver of subscriptions and engagement. But what this tells me, Kartik, is that with next season of the Premier League being the final season of the current deal that NBC Sports has, it's probably more likely that another reason here that NBC Sports will go ahead and push more games to Peacock and just really, really just ramp that up and try to get as many new subscriptions as possible to make that even more of a must-have than it is now.
Yeah, and maintain the subscriptions they have, because there are a number of people who, myself included, that just subscribe because of the Premier League. I don't use Peacock for anything else. I mean, most of the things that that they have, at least that are to my liking, are on some other streaming service as well. But they want to maintain those signups, and they're adding more and more sitcoms and new series, etc., to Peacock. So maybe they will have other sustainable bases of signups beyond the Premier League. But yeah, I think this makes it all the more likely that NBC feels like they're going to have to do what they can to keep the Premier League rights if it's the chief driver of signups.
Yeah, two recommendations for anyone who does have Peacock that's looking for programming other than the Premier League on there. And this has nothing to do with soccer, but just in terms of just me watching Peacock and looking at some other shows, two of my favorites. The first one is Escape to the Chateau, which is a documentary series from originally from Channel 4 in England, about a couple who buy a French castle that's run down, and it's about, I think, six seasons of it, and they talk about going ahead and trying to turn that around. Really, really incredible show. Highly recommended. And the other one is AP Bio, which is a comedy starring, I think, one of the guys from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And that's really funny. Those are the two favorite shows I have right now. Now, Kartik, some big news this week, too, is that World Soccer Talk has launched a brand new app that hopefully will be something that soccer fans in the US will definitely be interested in. It's called the Soccer TV Schedules app. It's available on iOS and for Apple phones, as well as Android phones. It's available in the Play Store. And what it is a TV schedules app, and also it has streaming listings. So when you log in, it's free download. No bugs, no advertising, no autoplay videos, none of that. It's just really very simple in its design, and you can go through and you can favorite your team. So I can favorite Swansea City or United States of America, men's national team or women's team. And then it will show me day by day if my team has a game on, which channel it's on, what time it's on, as well as all of the other TV listings and streaming listings. And what we've found through experience is that there's more than 36 different ways you can watch soccer on US television and streaming. 36 different options, more than 36. So for the average soccer fan who wants to watch a game, say it's Tottenham against Fulham in the FA Cup, well, where is that? Is that on ESPN Plus? Is that on Peacock? Is that on NBC Sports? Is that on, you name it? There's so many different options out there. So if you get a chance, check it out. It's a free download. Again, it's called Soccer TV Schedules, and you'll find it on both Apple and Android. Kartik, have you had a chance to kind of mess around with it a little bit?
Yeah, not only do I have I messed around with it, I'm now using it actively, and it'll be especially useful when Italy and Germany kick back off again, and Spain actually in less than a week's time.
I know. This is, yeah,
winter break, right, for any of those leagues, but that's COVID inflicted. But you're able to select your favorite teams. You're able to kind of sort the matches the way you want them to, and so it's a really useful app. It's not one of these apps where there are multiple layers and you have to do all sorts of things to find what you want to find. Sometimes apps get too busy even if they have a lot of information. This is really straightforward for you.
Yeah, and you can also filter by league. So if you're only interested in the Bundesliga, you can filter. There's a filter icon in the top right corner, and it'll just show you the Bundesliga as one example. And it's got some other features to it too that are definitely very helpful. It also has I believe everything on there. So in terms of everything from the Argentine League to some of the Asian leagues, African leagues, North American leagues, you name it. So the goal is to have everything that's available legally will be listed in the app. So it's actually got quite a big database of information that it's pulling from. So it's a great way to find out. If you love soccer, as you and I do, Kartik, it's a great way if you're looking for a game to watch or your team, you want to make sure you don't miss your single a match of your team. It's a great way to ensure that. Now, Kartik, let's look back at 2020. Let's take this year in retrospective. I think in the history of professional soccer, we haven't seen a year like 2020, probably since the First World War or the Second World War, when sports and soccer were cancelled, were shut down completely. This year has been a little bit different because we have had things continue. I mean, we're in a global pandemic, but we have people and leagues from around the world that have figured out a way to make it work and to play games and have protocols in place and slowly but surely bring fans back into the stands. So we're in 2020, of course, and we have these leagues and games and competitions happening. We really haven't seen much of a hiccup. We figured out, I mean, we being us, the soccer world, have figured out how to play these games. But Kartik, I think looking back at 2020 and looking at some of the highlights in the year in retrospective, we have to give so much credit to the Bundesliga for really being trailblazers in this whole protocol and how to play during a pandemic. What do you think?
I think for sure the Bundesliga has to be given lots of credit for getting the protocols right, being first back among European leagues, and also, quite honestly, really pioneering the use of 5 substitutions, the staff wearing masks, and this sort of really safe way of going about playing the matches. They've continued, they've persisted with that since their restart in May, which has been really good to see, whereas other leagues have kind of changed midstream, tried to open things up, maybe changed the substitutions rules, changed the number of people on the bench in the middle of the season, et cetera, or in the midstream because coaches have complained. So there have been a number of things that I think really stood out for the Bundesliga. Again, there's so much about the Bundesliga and German football that's done at a really professional level. It kind of fits the whole stereotype of German efficiency, but they got this right and they showed the way for the rest of the leagues.
Yeah, it was really like a blueprint, really, for other leagues from around the world to follow. The other thing, too, is the debut of artificial crowd noise. And we saw this through, I think, Sky Sports Germany or Sky Germany, where for some of the games they started experimenting with that. And that was something new we've never had to experience. It was really, really well done. I think in many ways, though, too, I think a lot of the things that the Bundesliga learned were adopted by Major League Soccer in a good way. And we saw with Major League Soccer in 2020, if you look back at the history of this league, 2020 will stand out in terms of MLS is back and how they were able to go ahead and play a tournament inside a bubble during a pandemic. And it was a success. It was a success. A lot of it, a lot of credit has to go to ESPN for really kind of managing the TV aspect of this. But the protocols were followed. And for the most part, most of the teams made it through, right? There was a couple of teams that didn't. But I thought that was really well done. And it was different. There was no fake crowd noise. MLS perfected the use of I guess augmented reality or placing of live advertising on physical objects. I mean, which was the side of, it wasn't even a stadium. It was just kind of a wall, as well as the center circle having that big Adidas logo there. That was something new that we haven't seen before too. And the games themselves were a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, it was one of those things that because there was no crowd noise, we got to hear some of the audio a lot closer of the players and the coaches and the, what they were saying. Some of the matches were great. Some of the matches were duds. But overall, I think MLS is back will be looked at as a success. Do you agree, Kartik?
Yeah, I actually enjoyed the tournament a great deal. I thought most of the matches were pretty good. And yes, there were some odd kickoff times because of the Florida weather, and you have to play either in the summer, you have to play either very early or very late in the state, and thunderstorms, et cetera, also. But I thought it was well done. The production was good. I thought the camera work, I think we talked about this a while ago, the camera work on the ESPN broadcast was really good for that tournament, and it set a nice precedent for what could possibly happen in the future. Now MLS has returned to their normal structure, which I think is quite frankly less interesting than this tournament was. The tournament to me was very interesting. What MLS did after August 2nd, when that final took place, or August 3rd, whatever day it was kind of blah. I didn't have any interest in it.
Yeah, it's funny because it's it really took the what is basically a meaningless regular season and turned it into something more exciting, turned it into something more meaningful, which was a tournament that essentially replaced the regular season. Now for 2021, looking to start back in March, we're probably going to go back to what we had before, but it definitely did give us an indication of what could be possible. Maybe in the future, maybe they would look at something like this or try and look at ways to do things a little bit differently. One of the biggest criticisms I've had for Major League Soccer for like, what, a decade now has been that they're very slow to change. They're very set in their ways. They're very stubborn. And the way that the league is structured, the way that the calendar is structured, all these things and many other things, they're very, very slow to change. And in other ways, as far as advertising, in terms of launching this tournament, in terms of sponsorships, in terms of kind of those types of things, I mean, new logos, they're actually leading the charge in many ways. But the things that matter the most, which is the product on the pitch, which is influenced greatly by the calendar and the schedule and the meaning of games, why or the relevancy of games, that's the thing that they're still struggling with. And I think we've seen that in the TV ratings, where it has been relatively flat in that regard. Which is unfortunate too, going into the next bidding cycle for the rights to Major League Soccer, is there haven't been massive record numbers kind of blowing the roof off the top type of thing. Now, speaking of television, some big hits in 2020. Ted Lasso was a critical success. It was a surprising success. Ted Lasso, among a lot of critics, a lot of them like non-soccer fans, has been a massive hit for Apple TV+. It's one of the great feel-good stories of 2020 on television. I think if this was on NBC or ABC or CBS, one of the big networks, it would have gotten even more praise and probably even more, it would have more reach. But this one has been a big success for Apple TV+, and more seasons to come from them too. It's already in the works. And speaking of television, Peacock TV launched. I think some of us love it, some of us hate it. It's not going away. It has provided us with access to the Premier League TV channel, and it's still a work in motion, as is CBS All Access, which is going to be changed to Paramount Plus. But I think in many ways, too, the streaming side of things is something that has changed greatly in 2020. And this is just the beginning, Kartik.
Yeah, Ted Lasso, huge hit. Really kind of a good thing for soccer. Also, English football breaking through into the mainstream in terms of viewership. A lot of people who are not soccer people are glued to their televisions to watch Ted Lasso every Friday. Apple TV did a great job of, and I think it may have been necessity because of lockdowns and not being able to film everything and release it all at once. But the every Friday thing really worked to get people interested in the program and engage and keep them engaged. Because what happens often with these series on streaming networks is that on streaming providers is that you binge once. Right.
Yep.
and you forget about it for a year.
Right. Or you cancel the service.
Right, and cancel. Right. Yeah. And so that they didn't do that, and I think it set a really good precedent. In terms of Peacock, yeah, the launch, I think we've talked a lot about kind of the clunkiness of the app. I got another complaint from someone today. I think it was directed to both you and I on Twitter about the inability to pause and rewind matches. Maybe it was only directed towards me. I can't remember. But there's constant complaints about Peacock. It first was that you were having to add another streaming service. Now it's about kind of the issues within the service. So let's hope NBC Universal can get that, Comcast can get that straightened out. But Peacock is here to stay, and streaming is here to stay.
Yeah, definitely some small incremental changes happening probably every month to Peacock TV. I mean, even this past week, they've now started adding a listing for the Premier League TV channel that's available through Peacock TV. They listed an actual description of what that program is, as well as what's coming up next. And that's a small change, but it's definitely a welcome change. And I know that a lot of the executives listen to this podcast and also read the website and the comments. So they're listening, and I'm sure they have a million other priorities also. But they're definitely listening to the soccer fans out there to try to improve the service and make those changes that are going to make a difference. Now, speaking of changes to make a difference, Chivas, finally, back on U.S. television. In the past, they were on Univision and got into a disagreement in terms of the rights for that. And so when they expired, Chivas launched Chivas TV. This is going back a few years ago. At the time, one of the biggest, most well-supported clubs in North America, especially the United States, of course, Mexico. But Chivas TV was a streaming service that was actually powered by NBC Sports. NBC Sports, for about a year, was involved in the technology part of it. But largely, it was, I would say, not a disaster, but it was not a success. It was something that kept Chivas off U.S. television. And we know from listening to this podcast, we know Liga MX, that the TV ratings for that league and those teams are enormous. I mean, the biggest in the U.S., regardless of language. And Chivas finally made it back this season to Telemundo Deportes for the home matches. So that's a big plus there.
Yeah. And I think it was really important that they got back on Telemundo Deportes and NBCSN for some English language matches. They took themselves off U.S. television at a time when Tigres and Monterrey became really interesting sides to the American audience, and not just to Americans of Mexican descent, but to just general soccer fans in the United States. We saw it again with Gignac the other day in the CONCACAF Champions League final. There's a lot of interest in Monterrey. Monterrey took Liverpool to almost to the death, right, a year ago in UEFA Club or in the FIFA Club World Cup. Mm-hmm. So the two clubs from Monterrey, from north of Guadalajara, these two big clubs have, I think, captured the new fans of Liga MX through their accessibility, through their success, and the fact is they're spending a lot more money than any other teams in this region, those two clubs in particular, even more than Club America or LAFC or these other big teams you think of U.S., Canada, and Mexico. They have captured a lot of the supporters I think Chivas might have captured otherwise. And you also have a Liga MX that's becoming more cosmopolitan. It's always had some really good foreign players, but now really highlighting the quality. And Chivas had fallen off. So I think this was very, very – I don't want to say it was a desperate move for them. And you were maybe a little more diplomatic about Chivas TV than I was. I think Chivas TV proved to be a disaster because it effectively seeded. See, if you're taking a full league off of television, or you're restricted the way Barcelona and Real Madrid are because they're part of a U.S. TV package for La Liga, which is on VN, which really hurts the entire league and every team in the league, then it's okay. But what Chivas did is their big rivals America are on Univision or Univision networks every week, right? Yep. And Monterey and Tigres were developing a supporters base in the U.S. Cruz Azul has a supporters base. They were off television, Chris, I think for 3 years, if I calculate this correctly. Mm-hmm. So I think Chivas lost a lot of ground in the U.S. So to me, this is one of the top five stories this year in the U.S. Television in soccer, because I also think it's not just, hey, triumphant Chivas is back. I think it's also desperate Chivas is back.
So, Kartik, I didn't mention this to you in our preparation for the podcast, but I'll answer first, but I'll have you think about it while I'm talking. But also, looking at 2021, what's the one big thing that you're looking for, the one big thing that you're most interested in to see what happens for 2021? I'll go first. And for me, this is 2021 is a major year because of the next FIFA World Cup. So 2022, Qatar, Fox Sports has the rights to that tournament as well as the 2026 World Cup. But going into 2021, there's a lot of question marks about Fox Sports' coverage of soccer. They've really dialed down. They've really kind of they've had layoffs. If you look at talent that they have, they've stripped away most of the talent. See, 2 years ago, you would have had Warren Barton, Kobe Jones, a long list of talent, Jovan Karoski, Eric Winalda. You go down the list, there was a lot of talent that they had. Nowadays, you watch any broadcast of a Fox Sports game, maybe Major League Soccer or U.S. Men's National Team game, and it's pretty much four people. It's John Strong, Stu Holden, Alexi Lalas, and Rob Stone. And sometimes we saw with the MLS Cup final, Moadu. So you have five. You have five people. Now, for the 2022 World Cup, I really think that Fox is just going to basically do as little as possible. A lot of it depends if the U.S. men's national team makes it to that World Cup. They should. If they don't, that's going to be a disaster, but I think Fox would probably not send anyone to Qatar. Maybe they'd have somebody there for the final. But even if the U.S. men's national team makes it to the 2022 World Cup, nothing's guaranteed. But if they did make it, I just see Fox not putting a lot of energy or effort into this tournament other than just the basics. And again, to the industry in terms of layoffs, budget cuts, etc., has had a big impact. At the same time, with Fox buying up rights for other sports, spending billions, hundreds of millions of dollars, I think soccer has gone way, way down in their list of priorities. So for 2021, I'm interested to see what Fox does to try to ramp that up a little bit. Do they make an effort? Do they try to start becoming relevant again? Because when you think about it, Kartik, a year ago, Alexi Lalas was all over Twitter, almost like daily with his tweets or his Periscope videos initially, but his videos. And there was a lot of interaction, and he'd be very on point, saying a lot of things that some of us disagreed with. But he was part of the conversation, a regular conversation. And while I like Alexi Lalas as an individual, he's very smart. I disagree with a lot of his viewpoints, and I often question whether or not those viewpoints are really what he believes, or if he's just trying to stoke the flames a little bit to try to be the center of controversy. At the end of the day, I think Alexi Lalas today on Twitter is far less relevant than he was a year ago or even 2 years ago. At the same time, Rob Stone is hardly on television anymore. Stu Holden and John Strong are they're probably the two main ones. So that's my thinking for 2021. I'm interested to see what Fox Sports does differently. Or do they scale back even more, or do they just keep that crew of five and keep things running pretty much as they are, which is really not much, nothing exciting, nothing worth talking about, really.
Yeah, I also, I know he's not everyone's cup of tea who listens to this podcast, but I think them being limited to MLS and CONCACAF Champions League and the occasional international has really limited Stu Holden's Stu Holden is very good. He knows a lot about football from Europe and from around the world. Maybe some fans don't think he does, but he does. And I feel like the loss of Turner's Champions League rights and Fox having virtually nothing they show has really deprived us of a guy that I think is pretty good. So that's another little aspect of what you were talking about regarding Fox. I actually miss seeing so much of Stu Holden.
So what about for 2021, Kartik? What are you looking out for? What are you interested in seeing what happens?
Look, I know I'm Johnny One Note on this, and maybe it's a faint thing, and I shouldn't even raise the subject again. But I just do not know how La Liga can continue another full year on BN and expect to compete in the United States. I think they're falling further and further behind. Look at the promotion ESPN is giving the Bundesliga. It's pretty unprecedented for a European football league in terms of what ESPN has done. Obviously, NBC has given similar or more promotion to the Premier League. Serie A is becoming more mainstream, more popular because it's on ESPN. And it seems like now what ends up happening is just in my own circle, people I talk to are watching a more Serie A, more Bundesliga. They still watch more Premier League than anything else. But the amount of La Liga and the amount of people conversing about La Liga continues to drop. Now, you can say part of it is Barcelona is down and Real Madrid lost Ronaldo a few years ago and Ronaldo moved to Serie A. So maybe that upgrade Serie A. He also happened to move to Serie A the year that ESPN got the rights, whether that's a coincidence or not. It was a coincidence, but it still helped ESPN. I just don't, Chris, think La Liga can sustain its profile in the United States. And I know they're trying to do a lot of other things, a lot of grassroots efforts, types of things that the Premier League isn't necessarily doing in this country, or Serie A isn't necessarily doing, or even Liga MX isn't necessarily doing in this country. They're doing a lot of little things to try and bolster their profile. But and I know, and you may come back at me and say, hey, if you get Fubo or you get Sling, you have BN. But the bottom line is the majority of people who subscribe to streaming services or subscribe to cable don't either have access to BN or they're not going to go and get the extra tier to get BN. So I think, again, I mean, even if they were to leave their English language rights with BN, that could be a compromise, and they force BN to sublicense matches to Univision or Telemundo on the Spanish language side or somewhere. It would solve a lot of problems. So I'm really going into 2021 thinking, especially given the change in the landscape of football or the world in general because of the pandemic, that this is make or break now for La Liga.
Timing is everything, Kartik, too, with this, too, because you look at, I mean, Ronaldo's, you mean, left La Liga a couple years ago to go to Italy. Messi, in an interview, I think today with Telemundo, was asking about the U.S. or talking about the U.S. as a possible future destination. And it sounded like it was sooner rather than later. But by the time that beIN Sports' contract with La Liga ends, which is 2024, chances are Messi will have left that league and gone on to someplace else, another club. So that window of time, that opportunity that La Liga had in the US was a missed opportunity. I mean, beIN Sports, for everything they've done right, the reality is they still have distribution problems. They're still not on Comcast, the number one cable network. They're still not on DirecTV, the number one satellite network. So for a lot of people in the US, beIN Sports is irrelevant. And for a lot of sports fans, especially more of the mainstream casuals, La Liga is irrelevant, other than maybe El Clasico, where that person might go to a bar or to an outside event to watch El Clasico, would make more of an effort to watch El Clasico. So, yeah, no, you're right, Kartik. It's for 2021, it's a pivotal year. Does La Liga continue at the same plateau, which it is a plateau? The numbers that they get for La Liga games are still relatively decent, despite their distribution problems. But at the end of the day, it's all about perception. And you're right. The perception is that La Liga is not part of the conversation as much as other leagues from around the world. And the perception is that they're losing pace on the Bundesliga and Serie A. Some of these leagues that in the past they would have thought that La Liga was, you know, kind of light years ahead in terms of the popularity in the US. Yeah, definitely good points there. All right, let's move on to listener mailbag. We've got a bunch of great comments this week, as always, from you, the listeners. First up is Dermot. Dermot says, I fully agree with you that play-by-play commentators should not be passing an opinion on what they think of a player or a team. Their job is to call the plays as they see them. It is the job of the experts beside them to make comments. Sadly, though, some play-by-play soccer commentators have been listening to too many US sports commentators and now believe that they are there to pass opinions or that we are even interested in their opinion. Next up is JP. JP says, NBCSN going away at the end of 2021 is an interesting development for the NHL rights. This is the last season of the contract with NBC. I doubt that the NHL would be on board with the majority of their games being on Peacock or shoehorned into a USA channel programming. Maybe this means NBC Sports knows they aren't going to renew. As for Premier League rights starting 2022-2023 season, despite all of the placating by keeping matches on television for now, they can read the same articles and see where it's heading. If they're happy to be primarily on a streaming service for the next contract, they'd be better off with ESPN Plus, which is a better platform. If they want to stay on television, perhaps Fox gets back in the game or CBS swoops in. I don't think that the Premier League is going to renew with NBC is a done deal by any stretch of my imagination. Rich says, so what percentage of games are we talking about for Peacock next year? Will there be only one TV USA game on Saturday, one on Sunday, and the rest on the Peacock? And Rich adds, also truthfully, I actually don't mind NBC games being replayed on the NBC Sports app. However, those that signed up for an annual subscription, thinking that they would be able to get all replays on Peacock TV are screwed and should be reimbursed. So Rich, to answer your question directly, we are talking about a greater majority of games being available on Peacock next season. Currently for this season, it's about 44%. So I think it's 175 games a season. And as each year has gone by, that number has increased. And next season, if I had a guess or an educated guess, I'd say more than 200 games, more than 50% of the games will be on Peacock TV exclusive. As far as the games, would there be only one on a Saturday and one on a Sunday? According to the predictions from that sports industry reporter, it looked like more games would be heading to NBC, the over-the-air channel. So there's not a lot of opportunity, though, as far as timing. So, but maybe a mid-morning or late morning on a Sunday game, although that causes issues with political programming on the West Coast, but maybe like that late, or maybe it's a noon Sunday game Eastern time, and then the 12:30 on a Saturday. So maybe there's one more on over-the-air NBC than what we're used to right now.
Yeah, so I think that there are a couple of things that they run up against with over-the-air. One is the requirements for educational program on Saturday mornings for an over-the-air network channel, which NBC is, and then the public affairs political programming requirements on a Sunday morning. They can work around the public affairs programming, so I think that Meet the Press is an hour, and then you have to set aside some time for your local affiliates to have public affairs programming on Sunday mornings is how the FCC rules at least used to work. Not sure if they've changed, but I think they're okay on Sunday. Saturday is where the question comes in. I think they can only show that 12:30 Eastern time kickoff on a Saturday. That's the only time slot that will work, unless the Premier League persists with these 8 p.m. BST, 3 p.m. Eastern Time kickoffs. The two morning slots on Saturdays cannot be on the over-the-air channel. So that you're looking at definitively Peacock or USA. And so I would say, yeah, probably closer to 75%, I think. I think it'll be maybe – or 70%. It'll be 3 out of 10 matches a week is what I would predict, or match days would be on USA and NBC, and then the other 7 would be on Peacock.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds about right. Next up is Brian. Brian says, it seems to me the Premier League deal is just too big for one carrier. As a whole package comes with a hefty price tag, I think it needs to be split with NBC keeping the Saturday national game and then everything else on ESPN. Or they split the weekend games. NBC gets the Saturday game. ESPN gets the Sunday game since they don't have football on Sunday. And then midweek games show on ESPN channels and ESPN Plus, which is similar to how we used to have it before there was ESPN Plus, where ESPN 2 had a Saturday morning game, the early kickoff before the college football games, and then Fox, right? Yeah, Fox Soccer Channel had the FS1. Well, it wasn't even FS1 then. Fox had the 10 a.m. game on a Saturday Eastern time, as well as the 12:30 game. And then ESPN 2 sometimes had the Monday game, and then Fox had the Sunday games. But that seems like a long time ago.
That was. And then if there were midweek matches, what would end up happening? They would split, and some of the matches would end up on ESPN 3, which was actually a good thing back then, because that was more accessible than any Fox streaming service or Fox Soccer Match Pass. It was something else then, right? Fox Soccer. They've gone through a bunch of
Fox Soccer Plus, right?
Fox Soccer Plus, right? There was a Fox streaming service too.
Oh, Fox Soccer .tv.
But Fox Soccer .tv. That's right. Yeah. And it had the same logo as Fox Soccer Plus.
Right.
But that's those days are long gone, and I don't think we want to return to that. I also don't think ESPN has room for it, honestly, because they have so much going on Saturday and Sunday mornings. It would only be that early Saturday morning kickoff that they could accommodate. That's even earlier now. It's 7:30, 7:45 in the days when they showed it. But otherwise, everything would be pushed on to ESPN 3, which I'm not sure the Premier League necessarily wants, because the other thing you have to consider with this is that there has been a lot of bandwidth by ESPN invested in promoting the Bundesliga. And once the Premier League is on the same streaming service as the Bundesliga, Serie A, et cetera, maybe they take some precedence over those leagues. The championship's on there also, but just slight precedence. With NBC, they have someone very, very committed to them. And if they were to go to DAZN or they were to go to Amazon Prime, it would be the same thing. Someone exclusively committed to them in the European Football League space. So that's why I don't take ESPN pretty seriously. I think the contenders would be, if NBC were to be challenged, would be DAZN, Amazon Prime. And I've been thinking a little bit about Discovery Plus, because Discovery, we know, has had interest in the Premier League in the past. Not this last bidding cycle, but the previous bidding cycle, they were very interested in the product, and they certainly have the channels, and they now are going to have a streaming service that maybe they want more than just educational and nature programs on. So that I think could also be a possibility. But I'm since John Oran's predictions, I've thought more about it and actually wrote a piece on it for World Soccer Talk this past week. I think it's probably going to stick with NBC.
Yeah, and my possibilities, I think the front runners for this one, NBC definitely, especially with Peacock being such a success for subscriber numbers and engagement numbers. Even the top level executives that know nothing about soccer at NBC, kind of the decision makers, not the people that are involved in the TV broadcast, but the people that the higher ends, the CEOs, now I think understand the importance of soccer and the importance of the Premier League and what it's providing to Peacock, which again is their number one goal. I think that the front runners are Peacock TV, ESPN Plus, and also CBS All Access, Paramount Plus, basically. So those, I really see the streaming being a big part of the next TV deal for the Premier League. And then maybe select games on television, but not that's not the priority. I think the priority is about gobbling up as many new subscribers to all these competing streaming services. And I think that's the way we go for the future. So for those of us who are just used to watching games on television, I think it's going to be basically, it's going to be Liga MX and World Cup games. You mean the World Cup, both the men's and women's World Cup, and probably La Liga will probably move to some streaming service too in the future too. But I think that's where we end up, is the big events, kind of like the Olympics, the World Cup, and Liga MX. Those are the things that will stay on television. Everything else will be on streaming. All right, two more comments to go. Anthony says, I'm surprised that the podcast's hosts are surprised that NBC may be in the lead for the next Premier League contract versus DAZN or Amazon Prime. DAZN and Amazon Prime don't have one critical thing the Premier League wants, which is consistent access to television, particularly broadcast television. NBC is the only network that has the ability to put games on broadcast TV at 12:30 on Saturdays. So this is a good point too, Kartik, because DAZN's a good example. DAZN is a company that when they launched, they were going 100% streaming. Everything streaming started in Japan and slowly made their way into Europe, primarily focused on boxing and fighting and MMA, but in certain areas of the world, definitely having more than that. Germany, they're big in. Many of the Bundesliga games and many of the sports in Germany are available on DAZN. DAZN's a big player in Germany. But the thing that DAZN did differently in the last couple of months is they're starting to sign TV deals. They're starting to sign deals with TV broadcasters to go ahead and find a way to distribute their programming, live programming on television. So even though DAZN is looked at as a streaming solution, a streaming platform, they're not opposed to actually doing TV deals. So that's always a possibility. DAZN has a huge amount of money to spend on rights. If they wanted to, they could be a massive player. Amazon Prime at the same time too, I think with, yes, Amazon Prime doesn't have a TV partner, but that doesn't, I mean, Jeff Bezos has what, more money than anyone in this world. If he wanted to, he could probably buy any of these TV companies if he was really serious about being on television. That's not where they're heading. So maybe Amazon Prime definitely has a disadvantage. The other thing about this, Kartik, too, is a year ago, if you asked me, why would NBC Sports, why would the Premier League be interested in renewing the deal with NBC Sports? One of the reasons I would have given you is that the Premier League can't build a brand in the US as well without NBC Sports, because NBC Sports has these events that they do where they go ahead to Philadelphia, they go to Boston, they go to Miami. So the big difference is a year ago, before COVID, right? Those Premier League events, the Premier League mornings, where there were thousands of people that came out, and I mean, yes, most people didn't like them on the TV viewers. But that's something the Premier League can't do. But now with COVID, I mean, when's the next time we're going to have an event with Premier League fans that come in from around the country to go to a public place to watch games together? Maybe 2022? You know what I mean? And even then, you mean, it'll take a while to get back to what it was. Is that now less of a priority for the Premier League? Maybe they're focused now on other things. But a year ago, I would have said that would have been a deciding factor in NBC Sports retaining the rights or renewing the rights for another 4 to 6 years. Now, less so. So I think an ESPN Plus or a Paramount Plus, if they're really serious about getting more subscribers, that's something that would be of interest to them. The Premier League, of course. And then, of course, ESPN Plus and Peacock TV probably going head-to-head.
Yeah, the one of the reasons I think DAZN might be a player is the amount of money, and again, you're right, DAZN is much more established in Germany than they are in the U.S., but the amount of money they threw at the Bundesliga to get a piece of the domestic rights package was insane, in my opinion. In fact, I would say it probably gets the Bundesliga out of the kind of COVID financial jam that so many other leagues are in. Just that DAZN package and DAZN seeing it as an opportunity to outbid Sky, although Sky retains some rights, right, in Germany, but far less than they used to have. I just think maybe this is their play in the U.S. is to somehow throw money at this property, or maybe it's the Pri La Liga away from the end. Speaking of my previous commentary about what I'm watching in 2021, maybe that's how DAZN becomes more relevant here. But I just think that they're going to be along on the edge. On the edges, on the periphery of some of these discussions, DAZN wanting to pick one big move, and John Skipper is probably plotting that right now. It might be the Premier League.
And that's the thing, though, too, is that the Premier League is an attractive property. So if you're a DAZN, an ESPN Plus, Amazon Prime, Apple TV Plus, Peacock TV, I mean, no matter which streaming service it is, you know that if you acquire the rights to the Premier League, with that guaranteed, that there's a huge audience there. Well, huge as in terms of soccer. So you get diehard fans that would pay pretty much whatever price, right, within reason, for access to that league. You would subscribe to wherever the Premier League goes on streaming. Most of us will probably go to that service. Major League Soccer at the same time is got their rights coming up, and Don Garber, I think a couple of weeks ago, talked about this too, and he said that the timing is just right for Major League Soccer in terms of the next TV deal. There's a lot of streaming services out there that would be interested in Major League Soccer, and while I agree with him that there is interest, there's going to be lesser interest than with the Premier League. I mean, with Major League Soccer, you mean, are fans that diehard, that hardcore, where no matter where Major League Soccer goes, will those fans gravitate to subscribing to that new service or that different service? In the past, we had Flow Sports. I mean, that's one place that some of the Major League Soccer games went to for DC United. I mean, so it's apples and oranges. I don't think that Major League Soccer is as well positioned as the Premier League. Major League Soccer can definitely bring audiences to a streaming service, but not in the same numbers or not with the same amount of passion and hardcore appeal as you would with, say, the Premier League, which is more of a mainstream league in the United States. But yeah, definitely good feedback there from Anthony in terms of about that TV angle, which is still important. And within the ESPN Plus, possibly with a DAZN, definitely with a Peacock TV, you still have that TV component there. And I'm sure there's other services. I mean, Fox is one example, but the TV is less important as those numbers keep on going down and down and down. But you still need broadcast television to be a component if you're going down that path of wanting to be one of the top leagues in the world. Last but not least, David says, excellent podcast, gang. Really interesting information and analysis of streaming developments and possible demise of NBCSN. Not sure about your comments regarding the London bias. Maybe your Swansea background tinged this a little. Nevertheless, a good informative listen. Yeah, and David, this is from my experience. I've been a soccer fan since 1979, actually, it was 78 or 77, and since the mid to late 70s, and Kartik probably since the early 80s, and just our experience in terms of dealing with a lot of journalists and a lot of media is that it is very London-centric. It is very, I mean, whether it's Sky Sports or Talk Sport, it is very much a lot of the discussion, a lot of the talent that's in that studio, whether it's Sky or TalkSport or London-based ones that talk about the Arsenals, the Chelseas, the Spurs, the West Hams. And you don't get as much discussion about, say, I don't know, Newcastle United or Burnley or an Aston Villa, because a lot of that talent really aren't that knowledgeable about those teams or don't have as much interest. So that was my take on that. Kartik, what about you? You're a little bit different because, I mean, supporting Manchester City, a northern club. I mean, what's been your experience with kind of the same. Perceived?
Perhaps being around Manchester City supporters and being connected with them in the years before the Premier League became mainstream and being on all these chat groups and message boards back in those days, right? there was always accusations of London bias, and that the commentators were always biased towards London clubs, and then Manchester United and Liverpool because they had London fan bases, right? They weren't it wasn't because there were a lot of Scousers in the media or a lot of Mancunians in the media. It was because they were Londoners that supported those two clubs. I think where the bias really comes in is I think there's a disproportionate number, from my own experience then going into the soccer media, there is a disproportionate number of fans of two clubs in the football press, which would be West Ham United and Tottenham Hotspur. I think there are actually a disproportionate number of Spurs fans on Twitter in general in the U.S. now that I've noticed it. And even in my political work, it seems like everybody I meet who's young, who says they like soccer, likes Tottenham. There might be something Spurs are doing right to actually do that. But just historically, and even when I've written for British publications, there have been over half the people writing for the publications I've written for connected to the UK have been Spurs fans or West Ham fans. And then you notice it even when you look at the background of writers for mainstream publications like The Guardian and The Observer, Independent, Telegraph, Times, etc. Disproportionate number of fans of those two clubs. You don't get perspectives of Newcastle fans. You don't get perspectives of a lot of fans of clubs from the Midlands. And there's also kind of a patronizing aspect. Oh, you know, she's our Northern football correspondent, or he or she is our covering the Midlands for us. Like it's some sort of provincial secondary place. So I don't know if the bias is as pronounced anymore towards Manchester clubs and Liverpool clubs, those four clubs. And obviously, if you look historically at the four biggest clubs in English football history, I would argue three of them are from Manchester and Liverpool, Everton, Manchester United. The fourth would be Arsenal. And then now in this era, Manchester City are as big as any of those clubs, right? So maybe there isn't as much bias against Mancunian and Merseyside clubs as there once was, but I think it's tough if you're a fan of a Midlands club, if you're a fan of a club from the Northeast, if you're a fan of a club from Yorkshire to see a fair shake in the media. It's just the way it is.
because
of where newsrooms are, where the writers are, etc.
Yeah, I was going to say part of it too is just where they're located. So the media capital of the United Kingdom is London, where most of the major newspapers and major media organizations are based. I think in some ways we've seen this in the past with in the US, with Los Angeles being with Fox Sports being very LA Galaxy and LAFC and Chivas
back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day, where they were more knowledgeable or kind of talking more about the LA teams than teams in, say, I don't know, Colorado or wherever, just because they have more access, they have more of a familiarity with them, they're going to those games. I mean, they're more interested at the end of the day in those storylines and those teams. And
well, it's definitely a thing in the U.S. in general. I mean, the opposite is true in America, or at least was when I used to follow American sports more closely, and still college sports, I think it's definitely true, where there's an anti-West Coast bias, right? Because all of the writers are based in New York or Boston or someplace in the East Coast, or if they're college football writers, Atlanta, Miami, right? These places in the South, Dallas. So there just aren't many mainstream sports people that are based on the West Coast. So there's this bias against West Coast teams or bias against West Coast programs, etc. It's similar. Now, they're all in one time zone in the UK, so it's not a time zone issue. It's just where the newsrooms are, where the journalists come from. There are also, I will say this, having been in a newsroom in the United Kingdom, there is peer pressure to where even if you have someone who's maybe not a football fan or doesn't have a strong allegiance to a club, comes from another part of the country, comes from some place where there aren't big clubs, right? Like the southwest portion of England, where if you're south of Bristol, there's really nothing. If you're from down there in that part of the world, you tend to then gravitate towards the clubs the other people in the newsroom support, and they are generally Spurs or West Ham. I mean, there are Arsenal and Chelsea and all these other clubs, right? Liverpool, Man United, but there is a disproportionate number of those two clubs, I found, just historically. And even if you think about it, the football journalists you usually read or reads columns, if you start thinking about what clubs they support, there is a disproportionate number that support the two clubs I mentioned.
That's what I love about the commentators for a lot of these Premier League matches are that they're spread out throughout the country. So, like, Gary Taphouse is from Bournemouth. Tony Jones from Wales. You got John Champion from
York.
We're from York, yeah. Jim Beglin from Ireland originally, but I mean, a Liverpool, former Liverpool player. You go down the list, and there are a lot of commentators that are spread out throughout the country because I think geographically, with many of them going to the games, they have to live pretty close to that region. So that's one thing. I don't see the bias in the commentary. I just see it sometimes in the coverage, whether it's radio or television. And again, too, some of it might be personal in terms of some of the personal bias I hear.
I don't see it in the commentary. I agree. And I know he's not always our favorite person on this podcast, but I'm going to defend Arlo White. There have been accusations by people I've seen on Twitter of saying Arlo White is biased whenever he calls a Leicester match. For me, he's not.
Right.
If Arlo White were a Spurs supporter or a West Ham supporter, he would never be accused of that, in my opinion. It's because he's a Leicester supporter and he's from the Midlands. So I think that these biases then transform themselves even in among US fans.
Yeah, and one more thing before we go on to the next item, and that's Martin Tyler. Martin Tyler, who we don't get to hear as much anymore, but in the past, for like what, the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, there's always been people saying like, oh, he's biased against Liverpool, he's biased against Manchester United. And anytime we interviewed Martin Tyler, he would always say like, no, like I know people say that, but you mean, he calls it so straight down the middle that you mean to try to do everything possible to make sure that there is no perceived bias. And even then, at the end of the day, I think people oftentimes hear what they want and they believe. And it's tough to, even for me personally, whenever it's a commentator being critical about my team or kind of just saying, you mean, what a wasted opportunity, they should have done better, whatever it may be, I take it personally. And sometimes I kind of think like, I can't believe he said that. But then on reflection, maybe a minute later, I'm like, well, actually, that was kind of true. It hurt. So it is a very personal experience watching soccer and listening to the commentators and listening to the studio analysts and the experts and the writers, which is one of the reasons we do this podcast too, because it's a whole other world out there that often isn't covered. And that's something that we do cover quite a bit, is that experience of listening to games and watching games from around the world, which we love to do. Speaking of which, if we want you to have your say, so if you have any questions, comments, observations, disagreements, or rants or raves, you can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on the mothership, which is worldsoccertalk.com. Don't forget about the Soccer TV Schedules app on iTunes, App Store for Apple, as well as the Google Play Store. This will be our last podcast of the year. So our next podcast is going to be in 2020. We're going to take a little bit of a break over New Year's Eve, kind of the New Year's Day, and then we'll be back the following week. And hopefully, like I said, Kartik, hopefully in 2021 we can actually meet up again, because it's been, I think, since March or February, maybe February, the last time we met, when we went to, Tuduene. Was it Tuduene? Yeah, Tuduene. Yeah, we went to Zona Football.
The right before things shut down. So effectively, I think that was the last match day in the Europa League we were there for,
yeah.
Maybe? Yeah, I think it was, or it was the next to last. Okay, it was the next to last. The next week was the one where there were half the matches were canceled. Wolves were on the plane.
Oh, yeah.
So Olympiacos already, so they played that match, but Nuno didn't want to. So the last full match day we were there, correct.
Yeah, little do we know. Yeah. So anyway, I'm looking forward to that. And for me and Kartik, this is a good chance every week to catch up and talk about articles and other things. Speaking of which, Kartik will have an article posted this coming week at worldsoccertalk.com, where he goes in and reviews NBC Sports' coverage of the Premier League. And offer some criticisms, both positive and negative, just talking about their analysis and how they've been broadcasting in the Premier League. So that's definitely a must read, and that'll be coming out later this week at worldsoccertalk.com. Kartik, before we go, where can listeners catch up with you on Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at KKFLA737.
All right, and you can find me at World Soccer Talk on Twitter, as well as Facebook and everywhere else. And listeners, thank you so much for 2020, for all of your enormous amount of quality on the comments and the feedback and the support for this podcast. It's been growing, and it's really kind of a fun part of the week that we always look forward to. So without you, this wouldn't be possible. So thank you again, and also thank you for supporting World Soccer Talk as we provide you all the information, insight, analysis, and everything to really enhance your soccer viewing experience with games from around the world. And Kartik, heading into a week, not a weekend, but a whole week of soccer coverage, actually probably about a week and a half before the next podcast, what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.